while we build our gardens where we are, knowing that what connects us is a planetary consciousness, that we are one Earth family. Connected through the Earth and in our life, we are divided by corporate globalization based on greed. And a greed economy must create a politics of hate and fear. It is time to say no more. We will rise with 300 million species, 7 billion people, in all our tremendous creativity that is just getting ready to be unleashed.
That's Vandana Shiva, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Vandana Shiva on eco-social justice on the global front lines. Despite the position of the Trump administration, which has labeled climate change a hoax concocted by China, there is virtual universal unanimity that the Earth's temperature is rising and that human activity is largely responsible. In the face of this crisis, Trump is cutting the budget of the Environmental Protection Agency and laying off staff. Is this the kind of response required at this critical juncture? The window for collective action to mitigate the effects of global warming is narrowing. Corporate-driven policies toward the Earth as just a place to extract resources and make money must be reversed if long-term tragic consequences are to be avoided. Sustainable agricultural practices and nutritious food are key to healing ourselves and our planet. Ecological and social justice are inseparable. Our guest today is Vandana Shiva. She's an internationally renowned voice for social justice. She is director of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Natural Resource Policy in New Delhi. She's the recipient of the Sydney Peace Prize and of the Right Livelihood Award, the alternative Nobel Prize. She spoke at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And now, Vandana Shiva.
I think complexity and self-organization is what make all these movements work so amazingly. So thank you to all the students and to the Environmental Center for bringing me here on World Water Day. I thought that was the reason you were calling me. And I had to send a regret to a very large movement taking place today on World Water Day to stop Pepsi from mining 5 million liters in the southern state of Tamil Nadu. About 14 years ago, women of Kerala had risen to stop Coca-Cola, which was mining 1.5 liters. And a wonderful woman, my lama, called me down, and I had no idea why. You know, I know why we shouldn't be drinking Coca-Cola. I mean, I've never understood how that horrible mix of stuff you don't know could become such a big marketable commodity. But, you know, I was inquisitive. I said, why are women rising against Coca-Cola? And found out so much about how behind every 10 liters of water mined, behind every liter of liquid sold, there's 10 liters of water destroyed. And the richest ecosystems become zones of water famine, and the women could see it. For women like my lama, or my sisters of Chipko, or the women of Bhopal, who are still fighting, there has never been a separation between ecological sustainability and social justice. Because the destruction of the earth is also a destruction of their rights. I did a study for our National Commission on Women about 10 years ago on the impact of globalization on the food rights of women and the water rights of women. Women are walking an additional 10 billion days because of the destruction. Now, if that isn't a human rights issue, I can't understand what is. So we have this very strange and rather recent construction of the idea that we are somehow separate from nature. If we were, we'd be very dead species because it's the earth that gives us the water we drink. It's the earth and the soil and the biodiversity and the pollinators and the sun and the photosynthesis that give us the food we eat and the air you breathe. I'm sure some of you, I mean, yoga has to be a capital, Boulder has to be a capital of the practice of yoga. But, you know, the big thing about yoga is pranayama. You breathe in and you breathe out, and what is basically said is soham. You are, therefore I am. The recognition that if those trees weren't converting carbon dioxide into oxygen, we wouldn't have oxygen to breathe. And beyond a point, you know, look at Beijing, look at Delhi, where the idea that freedom to sell cars and then freedom to own cars has to be totally respected. Every third child in Delhi has respiratory problems because we breathe that air. And it's the separation that was vital for conquest, the conquest of the earth and the conquest of cultures. I won't go into too much detail, except that the conquest of nature required the construction of humans being separate from nature, and nature just being raw material, but it also required a simultaneous construction of many humans being part of the nature that could be exploited. So hand in hand with anthropocentrism, which is the idea that we are separate, was racism. Race was invented as part of colonization. A new kind of sexism. And definitely new levels of thinking about religion, not as a faith, but as a reason for conquest. So when was it? 1492? They say Columbus discovered America. Well, Columbus had just lost his way, actually. He was coming to occupy India. And he thought he'd take this route. They didn't even know there was land here. And landed in Haiti. And the reason everyone who's native to this continent is called an Indian is because of that mistake. So I say one good thing out of a bad mistake, the solidarity of all Indians. Now, there is a very convenient way in which, if you read any history, you are told that Britain became wealthy because it had technology, it had industry, and therefore could lead to all this wealth generation. Well, 200 years before they had the industry, they had transferred all the wealth from India. We were 25% of the GDP of the world, of the wealth of the world, when the British came. When they left, we were 2%. Because this whole enterprise is basically like an extraction machinery, just like you mine for oil. You literally mine for wealth. And you never mine for social wealth alone, because all social wealth is created by working with nature. So the extraction is simultaneously from nature's economy, which is the foundation of all economy, and of all society's wealth. And there's a naturalization that's done that makes the result of this exploitation look like the status of those societies, that poverty is a condition that has been with them forever, rather than a result of an unjust society. I was thrown into looking at agriculture, not a chosen field of study for me, but I was literally thrown into it because of events in 1984. And I said, where on earth did George Orwell know 1984? Yeah. Why did he choose that date? Very useful book to understand our times of alternative facts. Well, the big alternative fact I realized in 1984, when I started to study agriculture because of two very, very serious tragedies in India, the biggest industrial disaster, the leak of a pesticide plant in Bhopal, then owned by Union Carbide, which has since been bought by Dow, which is now merged with DuPont. And the same year, in the state of Punjab, there had been a huge uprising of farmers. And it was called a separatist movement, and the army was sent in. That period of violence killed 30,000 people in Punjab. That one night of a gas leak killed 7,000 people in Bhopal. Immediately after that, more. And every year I go back to Bhopal on the anniversary. And I remember once a hall as big as this was full of children who were the children of Bhopal. Either they couldn't walk or they couldn't talk. And the women who are still fighting for justice took the award they got and put it to create a rehabilitation center for the children. So the Bhopal tragedy at that level is not over. So I decided to study the Green Revolution because there was a huge puzzle in my mind. The Green Revolution was given a Nobel Peace Prize in the 70s to a scientist called Norman Borlaug, who interestingly had come from DuPont Defense Labs. And he is called the father of the Green Revolution and of thinking about religion, not as a thesis was this is going to create so much prosperity that India won't go the way of China, so we won't have a red revolution, we'll have a green revolution through commercial chemical farming. But by the 80s, Punjab was a land of very deep violence. And I said, there's no peace here, so what was this about? Realized then that these chemicals had come from the war. Every chemical used in farming is a war product. Chemical fertilizers, synthetic pesticides, herbicides, Agent Orange used for the Vietnam War. And I committed myself then to practice and promote a non-violent farming. In Hindi, we say ahimsik. Gandhi's word, ahimsa. And then because I'd started to do this work on agriculture, and I'd written a book, you know, books make you experts. Life keeps you illiterate according to the hierarchy of knowledge. So suddenly I started getting called to all these agriculture meetings. And I would accept because I really wanted to figure out more. And one particular meeting was 1987 in Geneva and outside Geneva to assess the impact of the emerging biotechnologies. There was no GMO in 1987. The commercialization happened after 92. But the chemical industry was present. The United Nations people were present. Some of us had been called. And there were three things that the industry said at that meeting. They said, we're not making enough money from chemicals. We've got to find new ways. And genetic engineering, recombinant DNA, where we add a gene to a plant, we can now say we have invented something new and take patents. And patents on seed will be the big place for our profits. They were talking about $1 trillion. And the language they were using was, if every farmer can be forced into buying seeds for which they'll have to pay royalties, that's where our profits will be. And they also talked about how it was not fair that farmers save seeds. Because a patent is both a right to own, but it's also a right to exclude. And a patent on seed, you can now criminalize farmers for seed saving. They also said that US would be too small a market, Europe would be too small a market. So they had to get the world, because most farmers are in the rest of the world. And so you had to have a global treaty. And the first time I heard the word GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, was at that meeting. They said they'd have to impose these intellectual property rights to the rest of the world. I made a commitment then that I'd save seeds. I had no idea how you save seeds. But you learn anything that you need to learn when you begin to learn. It's our mental blocks that keep us. I don't know, I'm not an expert. You don't have to be an expert to live. And seed is life. So I decided I would save seeds. I started Navdanya, the movement for seed saving, the movement for seed freedom. I also kept a watch on what the industry was doing and worked with my government. So we worked on the grassroots to create community seed banks, because we knew if seeds are saved, then farmers will have their freedom in the future. And I took a lot of inspiration from our freedom movement, from Gandhi. The two aspects of it was, first, the recognition that some laws are so unjust, so unethical, that they are not worthy of obeying. This is what Gandhi had said when he said, it is our duty to disobey unjust law. Martin Luther King said the same when the laws said you couldn't sit in this part of the bus, you couldn't eat in a restaurant, you couldn't go to the same schools. And it took a disobeying of that unjust law based on race. Gandhi had begun non-cooperation in South Africa, 1906. He'd refused to obey the compulsory registration on the basis of race and said, we are equal citizens, we will not be divided by race. But when he came back to India in 1915, he was invited by the freedom movement to go to a place in Bihar where farmers were fighting against the forced cultivation of indigo, the blue dye. And he joined the Satyagraha. I'm going to do a pilgrimage because 100 years this year. We are right now, my colleagues are right now there collecting soil. And we're going to do a long journey wherever we worked for freedom, because we have an obligation to remember. There's a very powerful quote from Milan Kundera who says, the struggle of people against power is the struggle of memory against forgetting. And we won't just remember. We're going to plant seeds of freedom with gardens everywhere, with the soil that we'll distribute. The second part of Gandhi's teachings that I brought into our movement was the idea that at the end of the day, you know, if the British say, you won't make your own cloth, we'll make it in England, we'll make you grow the indigo, we'll get the slaves from Africa to grow the cotton, to harvest the cotton, we're going to grab the land of the First Nations. If you look at the record of how much violence was done to create those cotton plantations, it's unbelievable. So how many continents had to be devastated to turn cotton and clothing into a place for slavery? And Gandhi resisted this by saying, we'll make our own cloth. He pulled out a spinning wheel, started to spin, taught everyone to spin, learned it himself first. He didn't know how to spin. He was a lawyer, brilliant lawyer. Taught himself how to spin. And I said to myself, if Gandhi could walk to the beach and tell the British, you cannot impose salt laws on us that make it a monopoly for you, so you collect royalties on salt. He went to the beach, picked up the salt, and said, nature gives it for free. We need it for our survival. We will not obey your laws. We will continue to make salt. And we took the pledge. The day I started Navdanya, all our more than 1 million farmers who have become linked to the network for seed freedom, the simple pledge they take is, we've received these seeds from nature and our ancestors. And we owe it to future generations to pass them on in their diversity, their integrity, and their beauty. And look at the seeds outside. How beautiful they are. And we will not obey any law. that comes in the way of this duty. We didn't just manage to spread the grassroots movement. We've created more than 120 community seed banks that have been helpful to farmers in periods of cyclones and tsunamis and drought. But most importantly, I worked with my government. I said, why on earth should we recognize a fiction that Monsanto is an inventor of life? Seeds are not inventions. Modifying seed by putting a toxic gene into it, I said, is a pollution. It's not creation. And for those who get very, very puzzled with the complication of genetic engineering and the complication of intellectual property, as you just remember, the whole thing is about GMO, God move over. We are the creators. We managed to write laws in my country to exclude plants and animals and seeds from patentability. I was also invited by the government at that time, because I used to keep talking about farmers having been the real breeders. And they have bred for diversity, they have bred for taste and quality. They haven't bred for uniformity and nutrition emptiness. And I also said we don't have to implement a breeder's right called UPOF, because we'd managed to get into the treaty in GATT, a sui generis option, which means it can arise from within the country. So we actually have a Farmers' Rights Act in our country. Now, that doesn't mean that the corporations rest. You know, every decade, they try and return to play the same tricks. And we organize once more to resist the tricks. In spite of not having a patent, and in spite of coming into India illegally, Monsanto started to extract royalties. They're now in problem. They're in the courts. The government's taking action finally. But the cost has been triggering an epidemic of suicides. 300,000 and more. This year it's 10 more. 300,000 farmers have committed suicide in India. Indian farmers did not commit suicide. In fact, there used to be a complaint at the time of the Green Revolution. They don't give up. Well, that's part of resilience. Do not give up. Our cultures have taught us. In spite of, you know, we weren't supposed to exist. 90% of indigenous people of this continent were wiped out. And yet they're teaching the rest of us the significance of water. At that meeting in 1987, the corporations had said, by the year 2000, all seed will be GMO, all seed will be patented. And we'll be five companies. The last bit is true. There are now three giant corporations. Bayer has merged with Monsanto, DuPont with Dow, as I mentioned, and Syngenta with Clem China. But the other two aren't true. Most of the world is GMO-free because of movements. Most of Europe is GMO-free. Japan is GMO-free. Most of Asia is GMO-free. Most of Africa is GMO-free. Only four crops, four pathetic crops. Corn, canola, soya, cotton. Are farmers around the world screaming to say, I want to chop down the Amazon and grow soya? No, they're resisting. They've been shot and they've been killed. And there was a sister, Dorothy Myers, who was fighting for the indigenous people. And Cargill had her assassinated. We've had international trade forever. I mean, the reason Columbus and the East India Company wanted to come to India is because we had been trading in spices and textiles for centuries. It was taking control of the trade that was the real objective of the wars and the violence. And the free trade treaty of that time, most people don't know, the first free trade agreement was between the Right Honorable East India Company and the declining Mughal Empire. They bribed 500 rupees, which is like $10 worth today. They bribed a low-level clerk to get a treaty signed. Well, the WTO had only three elements that were beyond the normal international trading system. One was the ownership of seed, called the Intellectual Property Rights Treaty. The second was the Agreement on Agriculture, which has nothing to do with agriculture, it has nothing to do with food, it has nothing to do with farmers. It's about Cargill writing that treaty. Literally, the vice president was deputed to be the U.S. representative. In the case of intellectual property, a Monsanto representative has acknowledged. They said, we were the patient, diagnostician, physician all in one. We defined a problem, and for them the problem was farmers save seeds. And we offered a solution, and the solution for them was make it a criminal act to save seeds. And the third treaty that affects our food system is something called SPS, Sanitary and Phytosanitary Agreement. In effect, it basically is criminalize good, healthy, local, fresh food and legalize poisons in our food. I have watched the implementation of this in India, where Coca-Cola had been sued by us for all the toxics they add, phosphoric acid and antifreeze and all kinds of things. And the court was about to rule. And the lawyer puts up this sheet of papers and said, no, you can't, because the old law will have to go. A new law will come. And industry had drafted it. So under this so-called law, they even tried to shut down last year Gandhi's cold press oil mill and said, it's illegal. Why? Because Gandhi had not employed two scientists and didn't have a chemistry lab. The purest oil, the whole world goes to buy pure oil there. You take your groundnut and the oil comes out in front of your eyes. You take your sesame and the oil comes out in front of your eyes. But anything that intimate is a problem. Anything that builds and binds community is the problem. Cycles of renewal of seed, where the seed renews itself, is a problem. Nature, how can you cheat us? Why do you renew? Seed must become non-renewable, and we will put Terminator technology into it. We've succeeded in blocking the application of the Terminator technology for commercial use. The patent is now with Monsanto. It bought up Delta and Pineland, which holds the patent with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So over these many years, I have realized, not because I was seeking to work on seed and not because I was seeking to work on food. In fact, I was the kind of physicist who thought eating was a luxury. Why do you have to eat? Why can't you just think?
You're listening to Vandana Shiva on eco-social justice on the global front lines. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
And it wasn't that I went hunting for Monsanto. It's just that the giant corporations are finding in our basic everyday meal their biggest source of profits. So Henry Kissinger had said at the time of the Vietnam War, you want to control governments, you control arms. You want to control people, you control the food. And I say you want to control life on the planet and the entire planet, then you control seed. And that's why the attempt is so desperate. It rests on a number of myths, and again, it isn't that I found a myth and I countered it. I found the myth and I found it to be untrue. With my eyes, seeing fields, with my research, taking measurements. So one big myth is that industrial agriculture produces more. That's why you've got to spread the chemicals and GMOs. It doesn't. It's a very inefficient system, uses 10 times more energy as input than it can produce as food. And with factory farming, it becomes 100 input to one unit output. But globally, the situation is that only 30% of the food we eat comes from industrial farms. 30%. And GMOs only account for 10% because most of it is going for biofuel and animal feed. 70%, even today, in spite of a century of attacks on the small farmer and the family farm, 70% of our food comes from small farms. And small farmers are more productive. When you look at output, not at yield, what's the difference between these two? Output is all the produce from a farm. Yield is of a single commodity. And the minute you convert a diverse farm into a monoculture, you'll have more yield of that monoculture. That's a tautology. Not an achievement of chemicals or anything. It's just that you've converted an entire land to grow one crop. So I'll give you an example of a typical farm. 9 crops. Corn is 4 units. 5 units are the crops. You introduce a hybrid corn, you take it from 4 units to 5 units, say I increase corn, but you decrease food by 4 units. And that was the healthy proteins, those were the healthy amino acids. That is where real nutrition comes from. So we started to measure nutrition per acre, not yield of a commodity per acre, and found that diverse farms, small farms, ecological farms produce much, much more than any monoculture. More significantly, we found that if we were to do ecological agriculture, we could feed 2 Indias. Nobody would need to be hungry. In this system of industrialized, chemical, globalized food systems, every 4th Indian is hungry. Every 2nd child is malnourished to the extent they are dwarfs, they're shrinking in their height, and they're wasted, their body weight is too low. And when that happens, that person will never be able to perform fully, physically and mentally. And I always say to our government, how can you be writing off 50% of India's future? Just for 3 poison sellers? Another myth is the issue of cheap food. And this is what divides very often the social justice movement and the sustainability movement. Sustainability movement says grow organic gardens, have fresh food, but there's cheap processed food on the supermarket shelf and on your food stamps. And well, actually, what is called cheap is very costly. It's just that the people who are selling it aren't bearing the cost. In fact, they're earning huge subsidies. $400 billion annually is the agriculture subsidies. Doesn't include the subsidies that go into a Coca-Cola getting free land and free water to then steal from a community. A subsidy in terms of exploitation of farmers. I did a study because suddenly potato farmers in India started to commit suicide. And this was potato in Bengal. Bengal never grew potatoes. They're a rice culture. And during in 1942, the British had created a Bengal famine that had killed 2 million people. They were taking half of the rice as taxes and then exporting it for the war. A huge market. The women rose and said, we will not give our rice. The slogan was, Jaan Debo, Dhaan Debo Na. We will give our lives, but we will not give our rice. They're standing there with brooms as their little defense, and the other side are soldiers with bayonets. And yet, that triggered the Quit India movement of 1942. That triggered the independence. So when I find farmers in Bengal committing suicide because of growing potatoes, I visit, I do a calculation. For 100 rupees spent on chips, 1 rupee reaches the farmer. 1 rupee. But it's not that the farmer has a 1 rupee earning. The farmer has a 25 rupee debt because Pepsi is selling the pesticides and the fertilizers and the proprietary planting material. So within 3 years, the farmer's in debt. Like the BT cotton farmers, in debt because Monsanto was collecting royalties. I've now started to work in Bengal, partly because they've had amazing victories. You know, part of globalization is resource grab of a very high level. Take the last drop of water, the last inch of land, the last seed, the last mineral resource, wherever you can find it. And therefore, it is a war against the planet, as I've written in my book, Making Peace with the Planet. Land grab was a very big part of globalization. It still is. And in Bengal, there are two places. One was for a car, and the other was for a toxic chemical hub for exports to China. In both places, people fought. And I would go back again and again to support them. They've managed, the first time ever, land has been returned to farmers in contemporary times. And we are going to work with them to create organic zones in these lands that were taken away from them. I already talked about Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola. But what isn't counted are three kinds of externalities which are, in fact, subsidies. Because if those who are generating those costs had to pay, then the costs of that junk food, processed food, would be very high. So we've done a calculation. It's a health per acre, measure nutrition. Wealth per acre, assess the true costs. Just in terms of farmers' distress and suicides and the damage to our biodiversity, our pollinators, our soil, our water systems, pesticide deaths for animals and humans, the externality is $1.2 trillion for India alone. Can you imagine if we were to do this exercise for the world? What we are talking about in terms of the burden the earth bears and society bears. And then you add to it the issue of the health damage. I just put together the chronic diseases of today that are triggered by a bad diet. The obesity and the diabetes, the hypertension, the cardiovascular systems, the cancer epidemics. Just that is $1.5 trillion in treatment alone. This is not even taking the costs of what it takes to suffer all this, including for family and the community. So India's GDP is about $1.3 trillion. We are talking about the shadow of this kind of food production as $2.5 trillion. That's why it's cheap. It's not cheap for people. It's not cheap for the planet. It's not cheap for our health. In terms of health, the big complexity, which is actually very simple, and I was woken up to this simplicity, was when I was traveling to Ethiopia in 1984. You might remember that was the year of the big famine. And those were the days I was consulting for the UN. And next to me was a person. He asked me why I'm going. I said, to study the roots of the famine. And I asked him, what are you going for? He's from DuPont, and he's going to sell hybrid seed. I said, but you know, they have a drought, and hybrids need irrigation. He said, yeah, that's precisely the point. The more it fails, the more we sell. That is this market economy. So you take the toxic chemicals that are giving everyone cancer. There's not a person I know. I've had three nieces to whom I've had to help treat in the last 2 years who've got cancer. They're half my age. How many of you either know somebody or know of somebody whose relative, friend, family member has cancer? Just put it behind. Now, the same companies that sell the toxics that give you cancer then sell you the patented drug that you need for cancer treatment. So like the DuPont person says, the more it fails, the more we sell, the more people get sick, the more we sell. I won't go into details of how the body is a very complex system, and food is a very complex system, and this idea of Cartesian causality is just so inappropriate. As one brilliant doctor, when I was discussing with her, and she said, well, you're a physicist, you'll understand. This is not about two-dimensional space, it's about four-dimensional space. That's the causality we need to look at. But recently, we've just completed a study on our farm to see how chemical farms near us are performing in terms of soil health. compared to our farm. And I'll just run through data. So chemical farming is based on nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. That's all they put. In terms of nitrogen, nitrogen applications are leading to a decline of 7% in the soil. Decline, it doesn't add up. Organic soils, 21% increase. Potassium, minus 22, 84% increase in organic. Zinc, 37% down, 14% up in organic. Magnesium, very important for attention deficit disorders, 17% reduction, 14% increase in organic. Most importantly, organic matter, down by 14%, up by 99%. Now, between the nutrition issue and the organic matter issue, we have solutions to both the problem of planetary health and our health. Planetary health in terms of the fact that the poor Earth has temperature increase. And there's only one way we can address this, to both look at the built-up stocks of emissions as well as current emissions. 50% of all greenhouse gases come from the industrial globalized farming system, 50%. 100% of a potential solution lies in going organic, 100%. By putting carbon and nitrogen through nitrogen fixing through pulses. You know, the pulses have a very beautiful way to recycle the nitrogen in the atmosphere, as do plants for recycling the carbon dioxide. And our data is showing that this turns it into 2 tons per hectare. That's the emission gap that's making everyone panic about that 2-degree rise. We don't have to hit 2 degrees because we can meet that emission gaps by doing an agriculture that heals the planet. But it also heals us. And the beauty, and this is where, for me, a diversity community becomes so important, because ever since I saw the monocultures being projected as higher productivity systems, and they weren't, I have always celebrated diversity, but every day there's new, more evidence. I mentioned the biodiverse farms producing enough food for 2 Indias in real nutrition terms. But the biodiversity in the soil is increasing the nutrients, 60% more nutrition in organically grown food. 60% more nutrition. When you eat diversity, well, there was an assumption. The Cartesian assumption is food is just stuff. Yeah. And it doesn't matter. You can mix this and mix that. It'll all be fine. And so they said, oh, cows? Why should we waste our time giving them grass? Let's cheat and just grind up animals and feed them. It's called rendering. And then you got the mad cow disease because they rendered sick cows and fed them to animals, and that jumped to humans. And when 12 people died in England, that's when a reaction took place. The most important issue is, you know, Ayurveda is a big science in India, the first science of life. Ayur means life. Veda means the science. I always used to be puzzled. They always said you must eat 6 tastes for a balanced diet. And now they're finding out that our gut is a microbiome with trillions of bacteria, hundreds of species, 7 million genes. We are only 10% us. We are 90% bacteria. Now, those diversity of species of bacteria require diversity of foods to function fully. And it's when they don't get food, or they're killed because of the toxics, so many of the metabolic disorders get triggered. So many of the neurological problems get triggered. They're now finding so many of the neurotransmitters that allow a brain to function in a healthy way are actually produced by a gut bacteria. So it, healthy, diverse, non-toxic food is not a luxury. And any system that insists that our wealth should be diverted to spreading poison and punishing the poor with bad diets is an unjust system. It's unjust to the earth and therefore non-sustainable. It's unjust to people. And when it comes to food, there are no differences. All our bodies function in the same way. Our skin might be a different color. Our languages might be a little different color. Our genders might be different. We might have different fates, but food treats us the same. The earth treats us in the same way. So we have all of this amazing knowledge now. Knowledge from our grandmothers who said, you are what you eat. Knowledge from the new study of the gut microbiome. Knowledge of the new understanding that the soil is really a soil food web. The new understanding that the web of life is actually a food web. And one of our ancient Upanishads had said, everything is food, everything is something else's food. When we realize that the bacteria in our gut need the really healthy food, we then understand that it's not the pyramid. Remember the pyramid they used to draw? Man on top, always a man. And, you know, Adam is only a derivative of the word Adamus, which is Hebrew for soil. Human is derived from humus, which is the Latin for soil. We are the soil, we are the earth. And these attempts of separation have constantly, repeatedly failed and created huge violence. So we are at a watershed. We have this knowledge, and then we have the war industry. 100 years of habits of manipulating science, using governments to push poisons that kill, benefiting from war. They don't give up in a hurry, their habit of either killing or making profits through killing. This is the reason we organized a Monsanto tribunal last year, and we said, enough of a century of ecocide and genocide. No more. Every bee, every butterfly, every soil organism, every child of every culture has a right to food without poisons. So I just want to run through where the industry's next big vision is. They use different terms. They call it climate-smart agriculture because the climate change that they've created, they want to turn it into another marketing opportunity. Monsanto uses it all the time. First, they tried to say, well, we'll spray Roundup, and that's climate-smart, and that was defeated in the UN. It's not very climate-smart. Roundup kills beneficial soil organisms and increases the pathogenic ones. Monsanto bought up into 2015 the world's biggest climate data corporation and the world's biggest soil data corporation. So first they got farmers into debt for seeds. Now they want farmers to be in debt for what they call big data. Big data is the new commodity. And that's the reason they're running to buy a lot of companies in Silicon Valley. I think they just bought about 16. Other elements of their dream of a digital agriculture, they call it, is to have spyware in farm machinery. That's the language, not mine. It's Monsanto's language, spyware. They've joined with John Deere to create this. Now, what would the spyware do? Go over your land, collect the data on soil, send it to St. Louis, and St. Louis will sell it back to you as a commodity. We stopped Facebook from trying to get into this whole big data thing last year. Mr. Zuckerberg had tried to get in. And I got very uneasy because I was in a very remote field area, and every newspaper had 20 ads, full page, from Facebook. And we organized, and we stopped it. Well, that's not all. The Silicon Valley companies are preparing software for surveillance. And, you know, they're already using drones to spread Roundup, but they now want surveillance on farms. They're talking seriously about farming without farmers. The latest display in farm machinery was driverless tractor. I mean, the farmers had been reduced to tractor drivers. Now even that's been taken away. On seed, they had talked $1 trillion. On climate data linked to insurance because of climate disasters, Monsanto is talking about $3 trillion annually. And this is a recipe for creating a permanent cycle of debt. I want to read out two quotes that tell you about the mindset. John Hammer, who's the MD of Monsanto Growth Ventures, which is the firm that goes around buying Silicon Valley, he says, if you think about it, there are two people on the earth that need to know a lot about remote sensing. Monsanto and the CIA. And David Friedberg, who was the founder of Climate Corporation, which then Monsanto has bought, says, you know, I mean, they think they're smart. This man has a quinoa restaurant. And he says, I am ecological. I am green. But this is his understanding of the earth and society. I've come to realize that there are two primary consumption markets on the earth. One is the energy market, which is designed to feed machines, and the other is the food market, which feeds people. Without those two markets, none of the other markets will exist. And along the way, he forgot that long before markets, there's nature. Long before markets, there is society. And that is where true wealth is created. The illusion that there's, you can take money, which is just a promise, I promise to pay the bearer, and convert money into a construct called capital and give it mysterious powers of creating wealth, and in the process rob from nature and people their creative contributions, is the basis of both ecological destruction as well as social injustice. This is what has created the 1% economy. This is what has created a situation where 6 years ago, 388 men had as much wealth as the bottom half of humanity. It dropped to 62 last year, and it's dropped to 8 this year. And on that rate of decline, you can imagine the level of concentration of wealth. That is what's triggering the war against the earth. It's triggering the war against people, because you see 99% as expendable people. They're not in your scheme of things. And it's also triggering the war against democracy, because you cannot allow a robust democracy in a 1% rule. People will rise. And our duty is, in our times, to find the creative ways to rise with the earth, with each other in all our diversities, united in solidarity. It's time we realize that diversity does not mean division. Diversity is the basis of true unity. And over 20 years, the corporations have accelerated all their past ways of making money at the cost of the earth and people. Now is our moment to create a planetary alternative. While we build our gardens where we are, knowing that what connects us is a planetary consciousness, that we are one earth family, connected through the earth and in our life, we are divided by corporate globalization based on greed. And a greed economy must create a politics of hate and fear. It is time to say no more. We will rise with 300 million species, 7 billion people, in all our tremendous creativity that is just getting ready to be unleashed. Thank you.
That was Vandana Shiva on eco-social justice on the global front lines. She spoke at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Vandana Shiva is an internationally renowned voice for sustainable development and social justice. She's director of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Natural Resource Policy in New Delhi. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as David Corton, Angela Davis, Arun Gandhi, David Suzuki, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, and Noam Chomsky. We also have a series of Vandana Shiva programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to the University of Colorado Environmental Center. Tim Butler recorded the program. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.